From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Any inmate would beg not to be put in with Robertson. Robertson was well known to be a sexual predator of other inmates. If an inmate was put in with Robertson, it was with one purpose, and that was to have that inmate raped.
Four prison guards at Corcoran State Prison in California are on trial for planning the rape of a prisoner. Today, a discussion with prisoner advocates on the problem of one of the most brutal prisons in the country, Corcoran. Also, as President Clinton meets with the Turkish Prime Minister today at the White House, a reporter in Turkey faces a possible prison sentence accused of insulting the state. And more on Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet's extradition trial. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Nine Catholic church workers, including two nuns and two student priests, were shot dead in East Timor as they drove to the hills to offer help to refugees. This, according to reports from Catholic sources monitored in Rome and Lisbon. Five lay volunteers were among those reported killed by pro-Indonesian militiamen, their bodies tossed into a river. Misna Catholic News Agency yesterday named the nuns and talked about what they had been doing. Meanwhile, Manuel Guzmão, father of the East Timorese independence leader Xanana Guzmão, who was reported to have died in a militia rampage in Dili, told the Lisbon Daily Publico yesterday he was in hiding in the house of a friend. This from the London Independent. In an interview headlined, "Listen, son, send someone to pick us up," Mr. Guzmão, who is 83 years old, said, "I'd like to tell my son, listen, I have no home, nothing, and you know I'm not to blame for any of this. If you can, help me and your mother get to Australia." He said, "There are good people here. They've helped us a lot, but this is no place for old people." And President and Mrs. Clinton plan on being private homeowners, but it doesn't look like they'll be getting much privacy. A group plans to demonstrate in front of the first couple's soon-to-be new home in upstate New York tomorrow, even though the Clintons haven't finalized the deal and the sellers still live in the house. The head of the Westchester People's Action Coalition says demonstrating there will send a message. The coalition wants Clinton to act more forcefully against Indonesia amid the allegations its army took part in massacres in East Timor, and that army is supported by the United States. The White House spokesperson says Clinton's leadership on the issue is beyond question. He declined to comment on the planned protest. Four gay men who were booted out of Britain's armed forces said yesterday their successful appeal to the European Court of Human Rights means that the military will have to revoke its ban on gays. The government said it accepts the court's ruling but did nothing immediately to implement it except calling a halt to proceedings against other suspected gay men and lesbians. The European Court in Strasbourg ruled yesterday that when the British military discharged the four, it contravened Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which safeguards an individual's right to privacy. Unlike the United States military with its don't ask, don't tell policy, the British military flatly bans gays. California Governor Gray Davis has signed a package of health care bills that will affect millions of people and make the state one of three that let consumers sue HMOs for damages. California's liability law will let consumers sue if they're substantially harmed by a health insurer's decision to delay, deny, or alter necessary treatment. The new laws will also require managed care plans and other health insurers to provide a second opinion when a patient requests it and cover contraceptives, cancer screening, and treatment of diabetes and mental illness. Health officials in the New York area are reexamining people previously believed to be suffering from St. Louis encephalitis. New York's mayor confirmed yesterday about 40 encephalitis cases have already been reclassified as a similar virus known as West Nile-like fever. Three deaths in New York City and one in Westchester County are blamed on the virus. Meanwhile, the malathion spraying continues with controversy growing around it. Birds have been found dead as well as whole ponds of fish. Some big names are throwing their support behind Vice President Gore. Basketball star Shaquille O'Neal has joined entertainer Bill Cosby in endorsing Gore's bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. O'Neal says Gore represents the best opportunity America has to inspire young people to be better individuals. At a Gore fundraiser last night, Cosby said the election is a no-brainer. Gore's rival, former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley, also has the backing of some well-knowns, among them actors Spike Lee and Samuel L. Jackson. And last week, retiring New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan gave Bradley his endorsement. How do the innocent collect when they are released from prison after spending years behind bars for crimes they didn't commit? In New York, they sue for reparations. In California and Massachusetts, they petition lawmakers for relief, but what they're paid differs wildly. A bill before Massachusetts lawmakers proposes an examination of how the state should make amends, rather than leave monetary judgments to a jury or the legislature. Massachusetts Congressmember Tom Kennedy has proposed establishing a commission to investigate and recommend possible solutions. Civil libertarians say the system must compensate victims of its mistakes. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As Chile vowed to take Spain to the World Court over its attempt to extradite former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, the general's lawyers told a British magistrate today there is no evidence against him. The extradition hearing in London continues today, with Pinochet's lawyers arguing that the former dictator is not to blame for torture and disappearances that occurred during his 17-year reign. Yesterday, lawyers for Spain outlined 35 charges of torture and conspiracy to torture against the former dictator and described to the court some of the horrific details. Protests by both Pinochet supporters and anti-Pinochet groups continued outside the courtroom for a second day, with the two groups just 10 feet apart, separated by police barriers. While some anti-Pinochet demonstrators wore black capes and white masks and waved banners saying, "Which part of thou shalt not kill do you not understand?" His backers waved Chilean flags and celebrated the recent death of a well-known Chilean human rights leader. Joining us now to talk about the case, Reid Brody, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, who is in the London courtroom. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again, Reid.
Hi, Amy.
So what has happened today in the proceedings so far?
Well, today has been considerably less dramatic than yesterday. Today, Pinochet's lawyers got their chance and essentially have been trying to whittle away at the case. First, they have objected to the Spain's introduction of new materials. As you know, after the House of Lords ruled that Pinochet could only be extradited for acts that occurred after December 1988, a Spanish judge, Baltasar Garzón, sent reams of details of dozens of other cases of torture which occurred after December 1988. And Pinochet's lawyers have objected to the magistrate hearing those cases, saying that Pinochet could only be extradited for those materials that were before the House of Lords when it made its second decision. They've also argued that contrary to the European Convention on Extradition, which provides that as between two European countries, the state which is seeking extradition only has to present information about the crimes rather than evidence of the crimes. They have said that when one side, as in this case, raises the question of immunity, that goes to the jurisdiction of the court. And so the other side, Spain, must prove by evidence that Pinochet was connected to the crimes in order for the extradition magistrate to have jurisdiction. Now, if that were to be the case, which it probably will not be, it would turn what is a formal hearing into a mini-trial, which no one here is prepared for. But the judge took that proposition under advisement and may rule on it. Pinochet's lawyers also tried to show, and this is what they're doing right now, that Spain doesn't have jurisdiction, and this is probably their strongest argument. They're arguing that since the House of Lords excluded all of the cases from before 1988, they also excluded all those torture cases that had Spanish victims, and that the cases left in the dossier don't relate specifically to Spanish victims, and therefore Spain would not have jurisdiction to try the case. They referred to the Convention Against Torture, under which a state can try cases of torture or must try cases of torture when either the perpetrator is on their territory or either the victim, the perpetrator, or the place of commission relates to the state in question. And I think they spent a long time detailing that argument. Now, in fact, the weakness of the argument is that Spain, in fact, doesn't base its own jurisdiction on the Convention Against Torture, but rather on internal Spanish laws. Also yesterday, the prosecution in what was, in fact, juridically a fairly important move, said that the court had to consider the thousands or the 1,198 cases of disappeared people as continuing cases of torture for the families of the victims. And, of course, in that category, there are many, many Spanish citizens. So that's where we stand now. Pinochet's lawyers, after having looked at the Convention Against Torture, are right now discussing whether or not the crimes or the acts alleged make out crimes under English law. Because in order for Pinochet to be extradited, the acts of which he is accused must constitute crimes under Spanish law and under English law.
Reid, before you go, and thank you very much for this update that we'll be doing on a daily basis from the courtroom on Bow Street, the magistrate's court, where the extradition hearing is being heard of the former dictator, Augusto Pinochet. Can you describe the scene outside with the pro and anti-Pinochet demonstrators?
Sure. Well, right now, as a fact, since I've just stepped out of the courtroom, I'm looking out the window, and you have really two what would be holding pens. One of them decked out in Chilean, actually both of them decked out in Chilean red, white, and blue flags with the star. Many people have been, many Chileans have come on charter trips here to support General Pinochet. And then just a few feet down from them, parallel to them, and separated by a wire barrier, is another group of Chileans, somewhat younger, somewhat less in Chilean garb, and with many posters of the disappeared, with pictures saying "Dónde están," with the big poster of Pinochet that we've come to recognize that says Augusto Pinochet wanted for murder, torture, disappearance, and crimes against humanity, with a big banner saying Pinochet must face justice. And the two of them are kind of both facing out towards the street, not facing each other, but whenever there's a break in the proceedings and we all step outside for a moment, both sides try to outchant each other.
Well, Reid, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Reid Brody, Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. It's based in New York. He's in London right now as he observes the extradition trial of the former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Thanks, Reid. Okay. Well, we're going to move on to another significant story today. The Turkish Prime Minister Bulent Ecevit meets with President Clinton at the White House today with earthquake relief, UN sanctions against Iraq and Cyprus on the agenda. Ecevit says he's planning to ask the U.S. for financial compensation for Turkey's losses resulting from the sanctions against Iraq, although the U.S. says that most of those losses have been compensated by the UN for oil program. As the two leaders meet, Turkey plans to try a reporter from the Interpress service on charges of insulting the state. Nadire Mahir, a journalist based in Istanbul, faces 1 to 6 years in prison for publishing a book of interviews with Turkish soldiers based in the southeastern area of Turkey known as Kurdistan, a name banned from use in Turkey. The soldiers tell of army killings and other forms of government repression against Kurds in the region. Nadire Mahir has a court date tomorrow, and we're now joined by one of her colleagues, Farhan Haq, who is the United Nations correspondent for the Interpress service. Welcome to Democracy Now, Farhan.
Hi, Amy. How's it going?
Good. Can you tell us about your colleague?
Well, Nazire Matar is a journalist in Turkey who has written both for IPS, which is a newswire service, and for a number of leftist papers in throughout the country. The trouble she is in stems from actually a book project that she took on. She came out with a book this summer called Mehmet's Book, which is popular enough to have been in its third printing since coming out, I think, around June. And what Mehmet's Book is a collection of transcripts, of verbatim transcripts of interviews with Turkish soldiers who have served in Anatolia, the region in southeastern Turkey, where the Turkish government continues to wage a campaign against the Kurds. And even though Nadire herself did not write any comments or words of her own in this book, she has been charged with insulting the state, which is a fairly common crime that the Turkish government levies against anyone who writes about the Kurdish conflict. As you just mentioned, certain words themselves, like Kurd or Anatolia, are banned. This is regarded simply as a civil problem having to do with some people in southeastern Turkey. And using any words outside of that sort of narrow ambit gets you in trouble. In this case, the irony is that she's in trouble not for anything she said, but for printing the words of Turkish soldiers. And even their verbatim words are enough to constitute an insult to the Turkish state. And if she is found guilty, she may face a sentence of between 1 and 6 years in prison.
Now, how will the trial work?
Well, as I understand it, tomorrow she has her court date and will try to defend herself with the argument that she did not, in fact, insult the state. In fact, there are no words of her own that they can point to say that she is guilty of that. There is a possibility that that over the course of this court date, they may come to a decision about her case. There was an amnesty that the Turkish government made available to journalists who had been previously guilty of the crime of insulting the state. But the cutoff date for that amnesty was around April, and the idea is that Nadire does not qualify because the book came out after the cutoff date. However, as a result of this particular amnesty, several journalists who had been imprisoned in Turkey have been let go in recent weeks, and the irony is that at this point it seems as if Turkey is wanting to bolster its image and to say that it's not as harsh on journalists as it has for a long time been known to be. And yet, of course, they don't want to go easy on Nadire, or else they wouldn't have charged her in the first place.
Farhan, can you describe the kind of obstacles Nadire faces now on a daily basis, even before her trial?
Well, she's faced a number of obstacles for years, even before the book came out. Nadire, because she interviews Kurds, because she has interviewed people such as the hunger strikers in Turkish prisons, she has frequently been picked up. She is frequently, if she visits a prison, for example, she has sometimes interviewed people and then not been allowed to leave and in effect been arrested for a day without charge. That sort of harassment is in some ways par for the course when you're a journalist in Turkey. I know that the Committee to Protect Journalists for many years said that Turkey leads all countries in the number of journalists arrested. And right now, Nadire does face, I think, a certain amount of pressure. In fact, to the point where she has not wanted at times to herself to broadcast the difficulties she's in, because of course it could get you into more difficulties. And I do believe that even though she is not formally under arrest today, she is facing quite a bit of pressure. In addition to, of course, the possibility that she could go to prison for this.
Farhan, we only have a few seconds left, but you are part of a campaign to have her freed. I mean, ultimately not to be sentenced to 1 to 6 years in prison. What are you asking people to do as President Clinton meets with the Turkish Prime Minister?
Well, certainly it would be great if people could make their views known. The Turkish Prime Minister is in Washington today, so I certainly hope that there will be some people confronting him with this. IPS plans to. We've already written the Turkish Prime Minister, and on Wednesday when he talks to the National Press Club, we intend to bring this up to him there. But we're hoping that it doesn't come to the stage where we have to worry about her getting getting a prison sentence. But certainly, right now, if people are concerned, they should call their congresspeople. They should call the White House and let their views known that Turkey wants to be part of the European community, part of the international community, and yet it still conducts repression, not just against the Kurds, but on anyone who will even mention their plight or even the word Kurd.
Well, Farhan Haq, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Farhan, the United Nations correspondent for the Interpress Service, and I hope to see you later today at the news conference at the United Nations of Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader of East Timor. He's talking about his colleague, Nadire Mater, and you spell her name, Nadire Mater. Another reporter for Interpress Service. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to look at a precedent-setting trial that's taking place now in California of four Corcoran State Prison guards. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. I've just returned from Fresno, California this weekend, where I learned about a very significant case. Jury selection began yesterday in the trial of four correctional officers charged as accessories to rape. They're accused of punishing a prisoner at the Corcoran prison by placing him in a cell with a prisoner who is a known rapist. The men facing trial are prison guards Robert Allen Decker, Anthony James Silva, Dale Sean Brakebill, and Joe Sanchez, all of Corcoran State Prison, one of the most notorious prisons in the country. The March 93 rape of prisoner Eddie Dillard, a 23-year-old Los Angeles gang member who was jailed for assault with a deadly weapon, had been investigated 2 years ago by a state corrections department team and the Kings County District Attorney's Office. A convicted murderer, Wayne Robertson, known as the Booty Bandit, had told state investigators he raped Dillard repeatedly at the behest of prison staff, in part because Dillard had kicked a female guard at another prison. But because no officers would come forward with information about the incident, the matter was dropped. The Attorney General's office, which had been told about the case last year by Kings County authorities, decided not to investigate. Then, former prison guard Roscoe Pondexter came forward and described how he witnessed the fellow guards transferring Dillard into Robertson's cell, knowing that the 6'3", 230-pound Robertson would probably rape Dillard, who's 5'7 and 118 pounds. After striking an immunity deal with Pondexter, the California Attorney General's office convened a special grand jury and subpoenaed Pondexter, Dillard, Robertson, and several of the guards. We're going to turn right now for the rest of the show to Catherine Campbell and Tom Quinn. Tom Quinn's a private investigator and prisoner advocate who's worked on a number of cases in Corcoran. and Catherine Campbell, civil rights attorney, who's president of California Prison Focus. I met with them on Saturday to talk about this case and to put it into context of Corcoran State Prison and the violence it has been known for many years. I started by asking attorney Catherine Campbell to describe the case that's on trial now.
Several officers, including these four, I believe there were others involved who have not been charged or against whom the charges have been dropped for technical reasons or lack of evidence, punished Mr. Dillard, who had offended them in various ways, by placing him in the same cell with Mr. Robertson, who was a well-known sexual predator of other smaller inmates. Mr. Robertson had been used in this way in the past, and he was to commit the same kinds of acts of violence in the future against other inmates. In other words, it was a practice to put vulnerable inmates who were disliked by guards in the same cell with Mr. Robertson in order to subject them to his sexual violence. The Dillard rape occurred in 1993, and that was a particularly violent period in the history of Corcoran Prison. And you must remember that it happened in the Security Housing Unit, which is a maximum control unit inside of Corcoran State Prison. So the officers who worked in that environment had almost total control over the placement of inmates and their limited freedoms.
Well, originally, when Dillard was put into the cell with Wayne Robertson, whose nickname is the Booty Bandit, the officers, sort of in a pattern and practice, were able to keep it covered up. One officer, however, did try to do something about it and had Dillard tested and indicated that he had been raped. He wanted to send Dillard to a local hospital for a full rape diagnosis, but that was turned down, and the investigation was pretty much stopped at that point. What happened ultimately was that the Los Angeles Times interviewed one of the guards who was a participant in the event, named Roscoe Pondexter, and that article then coincided with a set of hearings that occurred in Sacramento shortly after that. And the Attorney General at the time, Dan Lundgren, was running for governor and probably wanted to be known as a law and order candidate. So he sent down some of his team to Kings County in California to reignite the investigation into the Dillard rape. What the Attorney General did was that they immunized Roscoe Pondexter and called him in front of the grand jury. The grand jury had previously attempted to investigate, or did investigate, the incident, but did not come up with any charges. Once Pondexter came forward, then the five guards were indicted. Catherine and I had, over the last couple of years, done classes about our work in a sociology professor's class named Al McLeod. So coincidentally, we were going to do a class there. Al told me that Roscoe was a student in his class. We had known that Roscoe had lost his job out at Corcoran over allegations of brutality and was with the basketball program at Fresno State. Roscoe was an All-American basketball player in his youth. And so we went to the class, really not having had any prior contact with him at all, and by the end of the class he had agreed to talk with us further as a part of our work on the Tate case.
The articles I read on it talked about how you were talking about what the sort of standard procedure was at the prison at Corcoran, and he was correcting you, saying it was a lot more brutal than you said.
We actually were showing a video of a prisoner shooting death in the class, and one that we had actually received ourselves only a week or so before, an inmate named Henry Noriega. And in the Noriega shooting, the gunner told the shooting review board that he shot for center mass, that is, for the chest of Noriega. And I made the statement in the class that this was unusual because guards are supposed to, according to policy, try to shoot for an inmate's extremities. And at that point, Roscoe opened up and said, no, that's not true. They're actually taught to shoot for center mass, but to say that we're shooting for the extremities.
So he came over to your house, Catherine Campbell and Tom Quinn, to talk to you about his work at Corcoran. He had been fired since then. What did he tell you over this four-hour conversation you had with him?
It was shocking material. Unlike, there had been whistleblowers who had come out of Corcoran previously, but they had been less directly involved in the violence in the security housing unit than Roscoe. Roscoe had something they lacked, which was direct, hands-on, daily experience with the culture of violence that existed in the Corcoran security housing unit. He told us details of daily events that were almost unbelievable, except that he is so authoritative and authentic a human being that what he says is undeniable. So it poured forth from him in a 4 to 5 hour interview in which Tom and I sat spellbound by his account of what was going on, what had been going on at Corcoran.
Roscoe Pondexter is known as the Bone Crusher.
Roscoe Pondexter is about 6'7". He must weigh 250 pounds. He's a very dark, black, African-American man. He played basketball for the Boston Celtics. He has a strong personality. And one of the reasons I believe that he was fired from Corcoran is that he had and continues to have a life and a reality, a family, and skills that made that job dispensable to him.
So back in the Eddie Dillard case, it was the first time that you had a guard breaking the code of silence. It had been investigated before, but now Pondexter was confirming what Eddie Dillard had said. And what did Pondexter tell you?
When we asked general questions about sexual violence in the security housing unit, Pondexter said, well, you are aware of the booty bandit, are you not? And in fact, we had heard from another inmate that he had been placed in the same cell with Wayne Robertson and that he had been raped numerous times over a 3-day period of time. And this was a reprisal against him for various ways in which he had acted out and challenged the authority of the officers at Corcoran. So we were aware of the booty bandit, we were aware of Wayne Robertson, but we had never heard the details of the Dillard rape before. He confirmed what we suspected about that, that it had not only occurred, but that it had been deliberately set up as a form of discipline and punishment by the officers.
And Dillard had begged not to be put in with Robertson, saying he was an enemy.
Any inmate would beg not to be put in with Robertson. Robertson was well known to be a sexual predator of other inmates. If an inmate was put in with Robertson, it was with one purpose, and that was to have that inmate raped.
And they wanted him raped because he had, kicked a female guard at another place, and so that's why he was brought to the SHU, to the security housing unit?
That's what I understand, yeah. I mean, my information, my memory now is more based upon what I've read in the Mark Arax's articles and the Esquire article.
Mm-hmm. Mark Arax of Los Angeles Times. We're talking to Tom Quinn and Catherine Campbell, both prisoner advocates in Fresno, California, on this week when the Dillard rape case is beginning. And it's a case now against 4 prison guards. It seems to be the first time that prison guards have been brought up on criminal charges at Corcoran. Tom Quinn, can you just give us a little context for Corcoran, how significant it is in the overall prison industrial complex, why people around the country should care about this place?
it was something of a social experiment that arose out in the early to mid-1980s, and it was designed to be something of a war on gangs. And the prison was opened in 1988, and the first inmates began arriving at the end of that time. The prison implemented policies which led to a quantity of inmate-on-inmate fights that I don't think has been rivaled by any prison in the history of the United States. And the policies were known as the integrated yard policy and the shooting policy. And essentially, the prison mixed inmates that they knew were rivals based on race, geographical location, and gang rivalries. And, for example, during the first 6 months of the SHU operation, on just half of the yards, there were over 1,000 inmate fights. And during the six-year period at which Corcoran was, you might say, rocking and rolling the hottest, six to seven inmates were shot dead, 43 or more were wounded, and hundreds and hundreds of inmates were shot with the anti-riot block gun, the 37 millimeter.
And the allegation is that they deliberately put rivals together in the yard. They would deliberately set up fights so that they could shoot prisoners dead or wound them?
Well, yes. Actually, they're not allegations. These are the statements of the leadership of the SHU itself. The policy explicitly, and it's in some declarations and other documents that are publicly available, was that all prisoners would be mixed regardless of gang affiliation, race, geographical location. The only prisoner that would not be mixed was if an inmate had specifically identified another inmate as an enemy of his and given reasons why that other inmate was his enemy. I might mention that Eddie Dillard had so listed Wayne Robertson in his file as one of those kinds of enemies and tried to encourage or beg the officers not to place him in the cell with Robertson because he had identified Robertson as an enemy of his. Mm-hmm. So it was a policy to mix rivals. The consequences were an explosion of violence at the Corcoran SHU that I think was probably unsettling even to the leadership of the SHU. And there was an attempt early on by the associate warden, Gary Lindsay, to get written approval for the policy of mixing rival inmates because, as he explained to them, this was inevitably going to lead to some questionable shootings. And about 3 months later, the most questionable of all the shootings occurred, the shooting death of William Martinez.
Let me add to this that the integrated yard policy was something that was implemented in the security housing unit, and the yards in the security housing unit are about the size of a handball court. So it's one thing to put members of rival gangs and rival racial groups on a yard that is as big as a football field in a general population area where they are capable of having their own territory. This is impossible in a yard that is so small. So on those yards, fights were inevitable. No inmate could be safe on those yards, and those inmates in the security housing unit were terrified of going to the yard. At the same time, if they didn't go to the yard and fight it out with their rivals, then they would be persona non grata with their own group, and they would be subject from violence from the people who were part of their affiliated group. So they had no choice about whether to go to the yard or not. So the yards themselves became scenes of mandatory violence. And then, in response to that violence, the officers who were in the control booth up above the yard would shoot either the wooden block gun, which shoots these awful wooden blocks. We've seen inmates who have lost eyes, inmates who have had huge scars across the tops of their heads and all over their bodies from these wooden blocks, or they would shoot the lethal 9mm gun, which is where all of the permanent injuries have come from.
Catherine Campbell, you represented the family of Preston Tate, who was killed in this way in the yard.
Preston Tate was the last inmate to die as a result of these policies at Corcoran, yes.
You found out about how he died. How?
Two officers, Richard Caruso and Steve Rigg, came forward to the FBI and alleged that this killing was a murder. The FBI initiated an investigation. This was on the front pages of the newspaper. Had represented families of inmates who had died as a result of unlawful shootings in California prisons before their family contacted me, and I jumped at the opportunity to represent them. I had heard about what was going on at Corcoran for about 8 years at that point and was really eager to challenge what was happening there.
Catherine Campbell and Tom Quinn, both prisoner advocates in California, based in Fresno. Catherine Campbell, president of California Prison Focus, and Tom Quinn, a private investigator. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll continue with their description of what's been going on at the Corcoran Prison and also this latest case, a trial that has just begun this week of four Corcoran prison guards. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with this interview with Tom Quinn, private investigator and prisoner advocate, and Catherine Campbell, civil rights attorney and president of California Prison Focus. On this day, the second in jury selection in the case of four prison guards at Corcoran who are being charged with involvement in setting up a rape of a young prisoner, Eddie Dillard. He had allegedly kicked a prison guard at another prison, was brought to Corcoran, and then put into the cell of a known serial rapist who, it has been charged, was used by guards to punish prisoners they didn't like. Catherine Campbell was just talking about the well-known case of Preston Tate, and I asked her to give us a thumbnail sketch of that case. Also took place at Corcoran.
Two things happened. One was that the civil discovery in that case opened up reams of material about what had been going on at Corcoran and led to the series of articles that Mark Arax wrote for the LA Times and the legislative hearings. The other was that the case settled for $825,000 and gave the family some sense that justice had been done. Those eight officers who participated in Preston Tate's death are still facing criminal charges in March of next year.
And they're going to be tried exactly for what?
Civil rights violations resulting in death.
And the case took, Preston Tate was killed when?
He was killed on April 2nd, 1994.
And how did he die?
He was shot with a bullet through the head.
And what was the scenario? What happened?
Preston Tate had been put on a tier where he and his cellmate were the only black inmates, with the remainder of the inmates on that tier, Southern Hispanics. Those are historically rival groups. He was sent to the yard with his cellmate. Two other inmates were sent out following him. The four of them immediately got into a fight. They fell to the ground. They wrestled. A shot was fired, and Tate was killed.
So you have the Corcoran eight who are going to be tried in a couple of months, and now you have, well, I guess the Corcoran four. You have one man who in the last few days had charges dropped against him, Jeff Jones, who was the guard who decided not to allow this case to go forward, the charges of Eddie Dillard to be heard by anyone else?
That's correct.
And then you have the other four. Now, And so what exactly do the guards face right now? I mean, we're talking 6 years after this actually happened, the repeated rapes.
They face possible prison sentences if they are convicted.
How is the guards union responding to this case in California? And maybe you could also tell us how significant the guards union is.
Well, the California Correctional Peace Officers Association is perhaps the strongest union in the state, and it contributes more money to political candidates in California than any other entity. It has an enormous degree of power over the governor and many legislators in California. It is extremely difficult, if not completely unlikely, that the California Department of Corrections will be changed because of their influence on the California government. They have, in the last 2 months, put on the television and on radio infomercials talking about how this is the toughest beat in the state and how difficult their jobs are and how unworthy inmates are of the public's concern.
What kind of effect has this had? Has this ad campaign had?
They've been very public about its intended effect. They say they are trying to influence any potential juror who might sit on this or the Tate case.
Mm-hmm. And what has been the response of the public to these ads?
I haven't... They're on commercial television, and I haven't seen them yet myself. They're, according to the article in the Fresno Bee, there are five of them.
What has been the reaction of the public to this trial, that is beginning this week?
There's been very little news about this trial until the last week.
Let me say a couple of things about that. I think the people in this area, and we're talking about the Central Valley of California, are highly dependent upon prisons as a source of income. More prisons have been built here in poor communities than any place else in the state. I believe we have between 10 and 15 prisons in the Central Valley alone. This has an effect on the consciousness of the populace, obviously. Small towns are dependent upon prisons for their income, and their population is influenced by having guards as neighbors and friends. So there's a strong sense of support for people who have to work in prisons, and it's understandable, and probably most people who work in prisons are good, decent human beings. At the same time, there's been an enormous amount of publicity about Corcoran. Corcoran is, I think, commonly perceived as an institution that was out of control, and that perception is absolutely true. My problem with that perception is that Corcoran is seen as aberrant, when I know that there are other prisons in California that are equally corrupted by a bad culture of violence, by a culture of violence that is perpetrated by guards. These feelings amongst the public, I think, are in constant tension with one another, and that this is an issue of some importance to the people of California.
You talk about the gangs of guards. It's something I read in the articles about the situation at Corcoran, that they actually were a gang.
You can't call the guards a gang. The guards would fall into various cliques that would then call themselves CARs, which is a colloquial term for a gang among prison inmates. You have to understand that a prison, particularly a security housing unit, is sort of like a stew where everything gets mixed up with everything else, and the prisoners adopt the culture of the officers, and the officers adopt the culture of the prisoners. So they develop their gangs in the same way that the prisoners have gangs.
Mm-hmm. So you had, for example, this group of guards called the Sharks.
Correct. And the Sharks were located in various places at Corcoran. They would hang out together. They would protect one another. They had bonds of loyalty that are similar to gang bonds of loyalty, absolute protection of one another. They had rituals of entry into the gang. In other words, if you wanted to be a member of the Sharks, you had to do something against an inmate that could get you into trouble. Everybody would protect you, but then you had done something like them, so you could never tell on any of them because they could turn around around and tell on you.
Can you talk briefly about a case that's notorious among prisoner advocates and prisoners, but maybe not so well known, certainly outside of California, and that's the case of a group of black prisoners who were brought over to Corcoran and were punished by the sharks. What that whole scene was like as the sharks prepared and how this came to be known.
What you're talking about is the Calipatria bus incident. My understanding of what happened, which comes from internal CDC documents, California Department of Corrections documents, is that it was rumored that a group of black inmates who had been responsible for an attack on a female guard at Calipatria, a rumor that was deliberately spread knowing that it was not true, was told about a busload of inmates who were being sent from Calipatria to Corcoran. Now, the greet the bus routine or ritual happened all the time. Whenever new inmates arrived at the security housing unit, they were commonly thrown up against the side of the bus. Their faces were lifted high into the air so that they could not see the names of the officers who were doing this to them, etc. It was a fairly brutal experience to arrive at the Corcoran SHU routinely. This incident was exceptional in that these inmates were all thrown to the ground, their hair was cropped short, they were taken off into a room and they were beaten. Several of them were forced to stand on the pavement in the 110 degree sun. They got third degree burns on their feet. They were really brutalized systematically by a group of guards who came to the prison that day simply to carry out this task.
Even those who were off, and they put tape over their names, and
there were 30 of them, and they were off duty that day, and they were called to come to the prison to retaliate against these inmates for something the inmates were alleged to have done at Calipatria, which the people who were running the incident knew was not true.
And this was when?
This was in 1995. Mm-hmm.
Any charges brought against the 30 who inflicted the pain?
No. In fact, the people who were participants in that were initially fired and then their positions were restored.
In fact, in the case of Eddie Dillard, even though this case was quite well known inside the prison and only now criminal charges being brought, weren't a few of the guards promoted?
This is a pattern within the California Department of Corrections. People are disciplined, and then they get their jobs back, and then they are promoted into higher positions.
An example of that is the man who was alleged to have led the Calipatria bus incident or to have authorized it as a man named Bruce Ferris. He was an associate warden at Corcoran at the time, and he also lost his job in the initial investigation. And he's since been restored to his associate wardenship and is up at a prison, I believe, in Susanville. I should also mention that at least certainly from what we understand, the sharks, for example, whatever the reality of that group is, as Catherine was saying, that the power within the prison tends to be in the car, that is, the group of officers who are together in a which. Oftentimes they share previous prison experiences together or other things. It's the informal authority within the prison. Bruce Ferris was alleged to have been the head of the car at Corcoran Prison.
So what do you expect to come out of this trial that is beginning this week? We're now in jury selection.
Well, we'll either get a conviction or we'll get an acquittal. Regardless, we're not going to get justice for the many, many inmates who went through the security housing unit at Corcoran. There were thousands of these men. And as part of the process of putting them through this integrated yard experience, which was truly a horrifying ordeal for these guys, those who repeatedly were involved in fights out of necessity or out of desire, were then sent up to Pelican Bay State Prison, where they are now housed in solitary confinement as a result of their involvement in fights at Corcoran. We estimate that there are about 300 men who are living their prison sentences, in some cases their life prison sentences, in absolute solitary confinement 24 hours a day at Pelican Bay State Prison as a result of having endured the Corcoran experience.
I would say, too, that the two trials that are slated, one to begin Monday, the other one in March, involving, I guess now, 12 correctional officers, the highest rank of any of the correctional officers being charged is lieutenant. The problems at Corcoran were systematic and policy-driven, ultimately. And whatever the culture of violence that sprang up underneath that umbrella and added its own twists and turns, they were operating within a policy and policies and under a leadership that very much tolerated or looked the other way in regard to all these abuses. What chance is there of getting justice in regard to that issue? It doesn't appear to me to be very strong at all.
What about the change in administration from Republican Governor Pete Wilson to Democratic Governor Gray Davis? I mean, under Wilson, they'd investigated, for example, the Dillard case and never brought charges.
It is simply unfortunate that our new governor appears to be as controlled by the California Correctional Peace Officers Association as the previous governor. So I don't anticipate that we are going to have the kinds of institutional changes in the Department of Corrections that would make it into a truly professional, well-run organization.
Davis attended a $3,000 a head golf tournament at Pebble Beach hosted by the Prison Guards Union, and was accompanied by his golf buddy, Don Novi, who is the president of the union. In attendance also was Clint Eastwood.
Finally, what do you want to see happen here in California?
Security housing units, by definition, because of the degree of power that the officers have and the lack of power that the inmates have, and because of the high level of incarceration and restriction of individual freedoms, because of the lack of programs, lack of education, lack of any opportunity, because of the hatred that they engender, because of the negative culture that they create, are bad institutions. We have five of them now in the state of California, and I would like to see somebody really look at whether security housing units are the way to go in terms of disciplining inmates who are involved in in-prison disciplinary offenses. They have used these as a remedy for that problem, and it seems to me that inmates that the way to correct misbehavior by inmates, and you have to understand that many people are in security housing units for simple possession of drugs in prison, nothing serious. The way to remedy these problems are individually rather than collectively. Isolating a group of wrongdoers in this particular way is a very destructive response to the problem.
Mm-hmm. And what do you say to those people who say there should be no sympathy for prisoners who have broken the law, are in prison, and then break the law again, that they do have to be cracked down on?
Well, I could say the usual thing, which is that they're still citizens, they're still human beings. But the perception of prisoners is wrong. There are many people in prison who have committed terrible crimes, but there are also many people in prison who are the victims of the war on drugs or are in prison for relatively minor offenses. We are living with the legacy of the three strikes law in California, and we have more than 15,000 people in prison for 25 years to life as a result of committing the most minor of offenses.
Catherine Campbell, Tom Quinn, both prisoner advocates in Fresno, California. Catherine Campbell is president of California Prison Focus. Tom Quinn, a private investigator. If you'd like to get in touch with California Prison Focus, you can call them in San Francisco at 415-252-9211. That's 415-252-9211. 9211. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, the number to call is 1-800-735-0230. Special thanks to Vic Bedoin and KFCF, which invited me out to Fresno this weekend, a very illuminating look at California. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.